Welcome back to the Private Equity Podcast. Our guest today on the show is Petro Poldorf. He's the Senior Investment Director on the secondaries team at Schroders Capital, where he covers the firm's global GP-led secondaries and continuation investment activities, with a particular focus on the lower mid-market. Petro joined Schroders Capital, back then Schroders Advec, in 2017, after 4 years at Montana Capital Partners, conducting due diligence on secondary transactions. And he holds a master's in quantitative economics and finance from the University of St. Gallen. And he's also a co-author of the latest Schroders Capital research on continuation investments, which we'll be digging into today. Petro, thank you very much for joining me today. And my first question would be looking at your latest study on continuation investments. Your update shows a transaction volume of $109 billion in 2025, which is above your own forecast from last year. And what do you think? Which driver was more surprising, the buy side, meaning record fundraising for secondaries, or the supply side, meaning GPs actively seeking the continuation vehicle route?
Thank you, Robert, for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be part of your podcast, and thanks for the good question. So it was indeed a bit surprising for us, the large increase in GP-led volumes or continuation vehicles volumes in 2025. I have to say that the supply side was not really a surprise, because we have over the last 5 years, we have consistently seen a lot of deal flow that even could not get transacted because there was not enough buy-side capital. Okay. So from that perspective, we believe that the GP-led market is still very much undercapitalized. And the surprise then came really from the buy side. And I believe what is positive to see on the market is that there are more players coming to the market. Also, traditional LPs are more open to reinvesting or even taking a lead or playing a more active role. So it feels like after 5 years of rapid growth in GP-leds, that it's becoming a tool and investment strategy that is appreciated by the broader investor base and attracts attention of investors.
Okay, I see. As similar to your last study, you maintain the saturation point of 13% for private equity distributions by 2045, which is significantly below the 31% of portfolio companies that you identify as CV candidates, meaning you think there could be 31% of portfolio companies that could be transacted through a continuation vehicle, but you still expect only a saturation point of 13%. What is the reason for this? Is it buy side capital? What do you think, or LP acceptance or governance friction?
Yeah, so maybe just to explain to the audience how we came to this number, right? So we approached it from two angles. One is to look at the secondary buyouts, and there in our study we have shown that that over the last 20 years, on average, 36% of all private equity exits were to another private equity sponsors, right? So those are so-called secondary buyouts or sponsor-to-sponsor transactions. On the other hand, we try to estimate the pool of continuation vehicle candidates based on the distribution of returns. So we look at returns of over 2,500 exits that we had in our portfolio. Mm-hmm. And we basically modeled a normal distribution or found a normal distribution within the exit. And then we looked at the well-performing companies, so that companies that delivered above 2x. And yeah, that's coincidentally also around 30-31%. So those two are quite similar, and it also confirms our thesis that some private equity portfolio companies are meant for longer private equity ownership. There are really good reasons why certain portfolio companies, and it's roughly one third overall, should remain longer under private equity ownership. And what we are saying is that what is changing is not this fundamental thing that the number of private companies that should stay under private equity ownership should increase. We believe that it will remain the same around, let's say, one third or 36%. But what is changing is who retains the ownership. So the old model was to sell the private equity company to another sponsor, typically to a larger peer. What is changing and what we are seeing is that the private equity sponsors want to retain the ownership to the assets, right? So that gives you, on average, let's say, a pool of 36% of all portfolio companies that theoretically could be suited for continuation vehicles. But our assumption is that approximately one third of that only will eventually turn into continuation vehicles, because you know, you could make an assumption that actually all such transactions, sponsor to sponsor transaction, will be replaced by CVs or continuation vehicles, but that would be probably too aggressive, because it would have really big implications for the PE market. It would, for example, completely disrupt the deal flow of large cap sponsors, which we believe would be too aggressive. So we took what we believe is a conservative assumption that only 13% will basically turn into the continuation vehicles, but obviously it can be more, it can be obviously less, and in the end the reality might be obviously a bit different. We might see also hybrid models where you will have some GPs buying some stakes and then the existing GP continues, right? So it will be interesting definitely to observe what will happen, but I think it's definitely a trend that every investor in private equity should watch.
Okay. And every investor should watch it. And so as an investor, should I simply look at your 2x TVPI thresholds to determine whether a company that's put into SEV is a good company? Or how do I make sure as an investor that well-performing companies are put in the continuation vehicles and not assets that the GP cannot place elsewhere as favorably?
Yes, that's a good question, and it's also a bit of our secret sauce to investing in GP-led or continuation vehicles. And every investor has a different approach, and the GP-led market is not uniform, right? You have various types of transactions. You have the multi-asset GP-led. You have, you know, very diversified multi-assets. You have concentrated multi-assets, and then you have the most concentrated transactions, the single assets. So everyone approaches the market differently. Everyone likes something different. Our focus as a firm, as Schroders Capitals, is on lower mid-market single asset continuation vehicles. We believe that those are typically the trophy asset situations. Obviously, there is a caveat that not all are the clean stories, as you alluded to. But typically, the single assets are really the highest quality assets that the GPs want to hold onto for longer. And those are interesting stories. And investment opportunities, we focus on those. And to really find out whether it's a true trophy asset or not, we probably don't have time to go through it, but there are really ways to do it. But important is to know the GP and the asset quite well, following it for a couple of years, knowing the history, knowing if there is really demand for the asset, if there was inbound from other GPs, if the GP tried to sell the company or not. So those are all good indications on whether it's a true trophy asset, or if it's a, let's say, a failed exit that is repackaged as a continuation vehicle.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. One key statement of your analysis is that the GP-led transaction is a misnomer, because many investors or many market participants that do not have too much experience with with continuation vehicles say that there's a fundamental conflict because the GP is on both sides of the transaction. But you argue that this is kept in check by the lead underwriter, a new anchor investor who sets the price and conducts full due diligence. In your view, is it sufficient as sole pricing mechanism, or are competitive processes with multiple bidders or fairness opinions and, of course, LPAC consensus absolutely necessary?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And just maybe to clarify the GP-led misnomer, why we say the GP-led secondaries term is not the right one. We don't think that the GP-leds, especially the single asset continuation vehicles, are close to the traditional LP secondaries. They are actually, as I mentioned before, closer to the secondary buyouts or sponsor-to-sponsor transactions. And the term GP-led is also somewhat misleading. It comes because the traditional secondaries market is LP-led. So to distinguish and to say this is something different, it's called GP-led. But it's not true that the transaction is actually driven and price and terms are set by the GP by the GPs. It's indeed, or it should be set by the market, by the market participants through a competitive auction. And in the end, yes, the GP sits on both sides. But what is very important in those processes is that there is a transparent competitive process being run that you know, LPs or all the key stakeholders are really kept up to date, and there is full transparency to why the GP is doing it, what they want to achieve, and there needs to be a price exploratory process. The price needs to and terms need to be set by the market, and that's, you know, this transparent process that is typically also advised by third party, by advisors, really can very well mitigate the conflict. But it needs to be run properly, and we are definitely pushing for the best practices because in a lot of cases, we also sit on both sides as an investor.
Seeing that Schroders acts as a lead underwriter itself, what's most important to you? Where do you draw the line in practice? Which governance shortcomings in a process would lead to you terminating a process regardless of asset quality? Is there anything?
So as just said, in a lot of cases, actually in 70% of the deals we do, we work with existing GPs. So actually in a lot of cases, we sit on both sides. And as you can imagine, we are really big proponents of the best practices. And we are constantly pushing the GPs on running the processes in a way that we believe is the market and best practices. So what is important to us, or what would be the issues that would lead us to terminate, or I would rather say advise the GP to change it rather than just saying simply no and walking away, is really the transparency, right? Access to information, involving the LPAC very early on, getting their green light to first proceed with the transaction, and then keeping them updated on the progress, on the bidders, who is involved, how is the competitive auction running, who is involved, and then once the lead investor is selected, also asking for approval, and then obviously beyond the LPAC, giving the whole LP base enough time to assess the transaction, to ask questions, and basically making everyone comfortable. So those are really the main governance points that we are pushing for. And if I were to summarize it in one single word, it would be transparency.
Okay, thank you. Let's talk about carried interest for a bit. You emphasize that GPs typically do not crystallize performance fees or carried interest, but roll them over to the continuation vehicle. How robust is this typically in the documentation? Do you negotiate hard rollover commitments for, say, 100% of the carry? And how do you deal with GPs who do not want to do this, but to enforce partial crystallization for their team?
Yes, so the typically refers really to the article where we were trying to really comment on behalf of the whole market, so global continuation vehicle market. So we cannot obviously speak on behalf of every transaction. We invest in a very small fraction of all GP-leds. We believe it's roughly 1% of all. So the typically is basically a caveat that we cannot say that it's always the case.
Okay.
But looking at our transactions, we always get full rollover. We think it's a really actually a starting point. It's not a standard. It's a good starting point. In a lot of cases, in the right transactions that are done for the right reasons, which is holding onto a star asset, the GPs are genuinely excited about the opportunities, and in a lot of cases, they not only roll 100% of their carry or any proceeds, they also top up with new investments. They also bring in new flagship fund into it. So that happens, and that shows really the conviction. What we are telling our GPs is those transactions, the continuation vehicles, are not there for you to cash out any capital. You can do that with a regular exit. If you sell to another GP or trade buyer, do whatever you want with that money, right? That's your thing. But if you are doing a GP-led where you are conflicted, you have to show really full alignment and full conviction and assess the rolling 100% of any proceeds, be it carry or GP commitment proceeds, is a starting point and non-negotiable.
Okay. Speaking of GP commitments, what do you expect to see in the continuation vehicle? And does it make a difference whether this comes from rollover carry or fresh equity from GP or management rollover by the portfolio company's leadership? What's your expectation?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, what is important to us is that there is a strong alignment and there is really excitement by the GP, which is demonstrated in the commitment they put into the fund. There is, I can tell you, Robert, there is no magic number. I can't say that 10% commitment is a good aligned commitment. It really depends on situation. In some situations, the GP does not realize any carry. In some situations, the GP is very wealthy. In some other situations, it's the first time they generate any proceeds. It depends on where the GP is in their wealth creation phase and so on and so forth, right? So there are a lot of nuances to it. So we are not looking for a single number, but we are looking generally for very strong alignment. And as said, this needs to come, if there are any proceeds realized, they need to be reinvested. And we also like to see the GP investing additional capital, bringing in potentially, if it makes sense, also investment from the flagship fund. And also on the management side, we don't count it as a GP commitment, but we are also looking very closely into how much is the management of the portfolio company or portfolio companies reinvesting. It's also a very good signal of alignment with insiders.
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned the most important point for you, or one of the most important points as an investor, is transparency, and this is also part of my next question. As an investor, the decisions to continue with the continuation vehicle, you mean to roll your stake in the portfolio company to the continuation vehicle or not, must usually be made within a short period of time, say 20 business days, maybe a bit longer. But usually, as an investor, or most investors, will not have the same information that the GP does, and maybe the new anchor investor does. So as an existing investor, what's the most critical point? Is it the deadlines to make a decision in the valuation date with respect to the portfolio company, or access to the new investor, to the new anchor investors, due diligence? What's most important if you are in a position where you are asked to roll over or not?
Yeah, so I would say you named probably two of the what we believe are the most critical points, and that's the deadline, A, and B, it's the access to information.
Yeah.
So if the deadline is too short, that should not be the case, because depending also on time of the year, but more generally, there should be enough time given to to the LPs to really go through all the information and decide what they want to do. So it's great that ILPA is pushing for some standards. I think 20 business days is good amount of time, but it's not the only thing. There needs to be good access to information. Obviously, if the LPs are given 20 days, but then the GP discloses the information only after 10 days, it's not helpful, right? So that needs to go hand in hand. Basically, full transparency. Ideally, the LPs have access to the same due diligence materials as the lead investor, and that's typically happening, what we see on the market. And the GP needs to be open for discussions with any LPs to really, diligently and also patiently explain all the questions that the LP base might have regarding the process, with ideally full transparency. So if those two conditions are met, there is enough time given and good access to information, we believe that this is a good kind of base for the existing investors and us, as we are always on a lot of cases also as a primary investor approach with those rollover opportunities. We believe that this provides a good base to really decide on what to do within the time frame.
Okay, thank you. Let's talk a bit about fees, carry, and terms. Your study shows that the estimates the fee savings at approximately 5.7 billion annually. This results from management fee that's roughly halved, 1% of net invested capital instead of 1.9%, and the carry structure that's on a tiered basis, meaning you have usually 10, 15, 20% thresholds that only are paid if 8, 15, 20% of IRR or multiples of invested capital are met. Are these terms, meaning lower management fee and tiered carried interest structures, now a market standard, or do you already see a shift in bargaining power back in favor of GPs for, well, highly sought after single asset CVs?
So there is definitely market standard emerging, or I would say it has already emerged, and it's indeed in line with what you said and what we mentioned in the article. There is always a management fee that is 1% or even less. So we see typically in the range of 0.5% to 1%. It also depends on the size of the continuation vehicle. The bigger the continuation vehicle, the lower the fee should be, right? And also the carry is tiered to really incentivize the manager to outperform. So it is indeed a market standard that also the advisors are pointing to typically in the processes and guiding the GPs. So it's quite rare that we would see a very strong deviation from that. It can happen. We had a few cases like that, especially the situation that you mentioned. If it's really a kind of a smaller, very high quality, oversubscribed GP with really high quality asset, that it ticks all the boxes, then it can happen that the competitive auction basically leads to premium terms for the lead investors to really differentiate. So we sometimes see it, but I have to say this is exception rather than a rule.
Okay. And the tiered carry structure incentivizes outperformance, meaning maybe for a GP taking on more risk. However, in a single asset CV without any diversification, the LP bears the concentrated risk. And how do you price this in? Through the hurdle structure, entry price, or the tiering of carried interest itself?
It's a good question. So from our perspective as Trodos Capital, I mentioned we focus on a lower mid-market single asset continuation vehicles. And our approach is not to say the single asset continuation vehicles are more risky because they are more concentrated than the multi-asset continuation vehicles. And that's why we should apply different terms or price in additional additional discounts. Our approach, and that we really did already 5-6 years ago when we started focusing on GPLs or continuation vehicles, was to really approach it with a direct investor mindset. So we are basically trying to replicate the analysis and the approach that our GPs are doing when they are investing. And all the GPs always invest in single companies. None of the GPs is, or a vast majority is not doing multi-asset transactions. So our approach is direct investment approach. And we know how to underwrite, how to analyze, how to diligence, and how to negotiate a concentrated single asset transaction. So the process needs to be tailored to that. But having said that, to your point, kind of looking at the hurdles and terms, multi-assets versus single assets, we actually believe that the single assets are better aligned because in single asset transactions, it's much harder to generate any early liquidity through sale of, you know, one of the portfolio companies that you typically have in multi-assets, that in a year or two, you sell one of the smaller companies or the GP sells one of the companies, locks in the hurdle and then drives the upside. In single assets, there is no option like that. So if there is a tiered carry and there is just one bullet exit, unless you do a partial exit or recap, but that's, again, quite rare. If you have just one single exit in 3, 4, 5 years, the GP really needs to deliver good performance to meet the highest hurdle. So we believe that the tiered carry, which is, by the way, very similar in multi-assets and single assets, and it's actually interesting to see that it's aligned, But we actually see it favorably because in single assets, it's harder to reach the higher carry. And hence, we believe the GPs are more motivated and better aligned.
Okay. Then now let's talk a bit about your outlook, about structural developments in the market. You mentioned multi-asset CVs are gaining importance over single asset deals because they offer LPs at diversification, but increased valuation complexity as well, obviously, as the price must be determined for a portfolio of companies. From Schroeder's or from an investor's perspective, where do the greater governance and conflicts of interest risks lie, in a concentrated single asset deal where everything hinges on the pricing of a single company, or in a multi-asset deal where cross-subsidization between strong and weak asset becomes possible?
We definitely believe that the conflict or risk of conflict, let's say, is bigger in the multi-assets, continuation vehicles. In the single assets, and again, it depends on situation, but the situations we invest in, typically the trophy asset situations, it's actually not that hard to find out what the fair value is. Those are typically highly sought after companies in attractive sectors. So there is very good price validation. In a lot of cases, the GP receives inbound interest, receives offers from strategics, from PE firms, and it's relatively easier to really set the price or make sure that the price is really fair value and market price. In multi-assets, as again, depending on situation, there are concentrated multi-assets which are more closer to the single assets, only trophy assets, two or three, but you have also more diversified. But the more diversified you go, the more conflict there is, because there is also high risk of mixed quality of assets being put into the continuation vehicle. So in those situations, the GP obviously puts in a lot of high quality assets to make it attractive, but also uses that opportunity to generate bigger liquidity event by including some assets that are not developing that well or that are harder to sell or where they even failed to sell. The idea is to package it and then make an exit in several years. In those situations, it's really hard to price each asset. Also, the buyers cannot spend so much time on single company if you have 5 or 10 companies. So those transactions, the more diversified GP-leds are actually closer to the more diversified LP secondaries, and the line might get a bit blurred, and there you run a risk of some assets being mispriced. So we believe that, you know, there should be good governance standards for all GP-leds, but I would say the more diversified you go, the more emphasis there needs to be put on how the price was set, and really trying to explain to the LPs that you know, there is line by line pricing, and that some assets are priced at a discount, some maybe at premium, and that creates the overall price. And there needs to be kind of good explanation why each asset is priced like it is priced.
Okay. The the article states that two-thirds of your deal flow has an enterprise value below $750 million, and you describe the segment as less vulnerable to displacement because less than 25% of the deals come from other funds. But it's precisely there that you are increasingly competing for CV deal flow with larger firms that are moving down market. And how is this additional capital, this influx of capital, changing pricing and terms discipline in a segment that has, at least until now, thrived on its inefficiency?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Robert. And we actually receive it a lot from our investors, because a lot of investors notice that lower mid-market has consistently outperformed large cap, and they are looking at allocating more to lower mid-market, and there are indeed players that traditionally focus on mega cap, large cap, looking at lower mid-market. So it's a valid concern, and our investors are asking about it. And it's true that for certain part of the mid-market, the competition is indeed increasing. But it's important to speak about definition and sizes, right? If you move from billion plus continuation vehicles to 500 to a billion, there you might have really a lot of competition, because a lot of the players can, the large players, they write tickets of 200-400 million in size, and they can still very much lead the, let's say, 500 plus, 500 to a billion continuation vehicles. But there is natural barrier to entry for the smaller continuation vehicles. And in our case, we typically work on even smaller continuation vehicles that are in 100 million in size, can be even lower, to 200 million, or maybe up to 300. That's really the sweet spot. And there is natural entry barrier, because if you have a investor that needs to invest 200 million ticket, they cannot do it in a 150 million continuation vehicle. So naturally, the true lower mid-market, the really the smaller end, is protected by you know, protected from the very large players. And actually, based on that, and based on our focus on that part of the market, in the last 5 years, we haven't seen really any increase in competition. Okay. In a lot of cases, the large players might try to get access, but the size really limits them. And also the relationship with the GPs. The GPs do not want to work with parties that they have never worked with before. They typically, the smaller GPs want to work with trusted partners, people that they know, that they worked with, and they know they can deliver. And it's not necessarily also back to the governance point, for a continuation vehicle and for the process, it's not necessary to run it fully, full competition, including all the buyers globally, to arrive at really market pricing. From our experience, it's really for high quality, smaller continuation vehicles, it's enough to include 3-4 parties to really have enough competitive tension and arrive at market standard. So we feel very much protected, also based on natural barriers. And we believe that going forward, this part of the market will remain quite shielded from fierce competition.
Okay, thank you, Peter. My last question is the following. Seeing that large buyout and secondary firms are increasingly launching dedicated continuation strategies, if the same firms act as GPs, lead underwriters, and LPs, in various transactions going forward. Doesn't that dilute the independent pricing discipline on which your misnomer thesis of the GP-led secondary ultimately rests?
Yeah, so the GPs, especially the larger GPs, launching GP-led strategies is actually a very interesting trend. And it indeed, rightly so, raises some concerns on, you know, why are the GPs doing it, and, you know, are they investing now in companies of their competitors, and how should that work, and indeed, does it kind of dilute the proposition of GP-leds? So it is interesting, but if you take one step back and look at the market as a whole, the capital that has been raised by those players, it's impressive, right, to see that they raise $1-2 billion for this strategy, but it's a drop in an ocean, right? So yeah, they are absolutely not disrupting the market. We don't think that they ever will. So it's an interesting element. It's, you know, more than any disruption or any kind of principal conflict, it actually validates the thesis of GP-leds and continuation vehicles being really attractive as the GPs are trying to get access to those. So I think it more validates the thesis than basically anything else. And what will be, maybe when we speak about the outlook, what will really drive the growth? It won't be the GPs, you know, the CVC and Advance of this world launching GP-led strategies and taking half of the market. It will be the big investors stepping into the market. I'm speaking about sovereign funds, the large pension funds, basically deciding to play more active role and either maybe starting rolling more. So from the current market of average of 10-15% rolls, this can increase to 50%, right, if the big players do it. And then the next step for them is also to become more active. So these players, the very big allocators, they could be really the needle movers for the market.
Okay. Petra, thank you very much for taking the time. Thank you very much for talking with me about your latest article on continuation investments. I would be pleased to do this again next year or the year after. I'm guessing you will continue to do your research. And so to our listeners, please look up the Schroeder's continuation investments article for yourself. And Petra, thank you very much again.
Thank you very much. And thank you for the very good questions. It was a pleasure.